Blog Talk Radio.
I have returned to the land.
Alrighty, welcome to the January 31st edition of Rebel Guard Radio. I am your main host, KZ, and I'm on the line with my my other tag team partners, Alex Saint and Vengeance David Fuller. What's up, Ellis?
Hey, what's going on? I'm disappointed, man. I didn't hear Walk as the intro, and then I'm the host of Rebel Guard Radio, as we all know. With KZ,
I couldn't
and
find it.
You couldn't find
it. I couldn't
Walk.
Find it. I've been under the weather, dude, so I haven't been, you know, on the computer. I've been sleeping a lot. But
this is why I'm going to fire you from Rebel Guard Radio.
Oh, that's right. Oh, did you pick up your back brace today?
I did, man.
Motherfucker.
Gotta carry you on another show, man.
Well, all right, enough of the bullshit. We have the whole fucking show. Rob Van Dam on the line. How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing excellent, man, and I love the censorship I hear you guys displaying. It's fucking sweet.
Tremendous. Welcome to Rubber Guard.
Right on, man. Glad to be here.
How you doing tonight, brother?
Today's a good night, man. There's no such thing as a bad day in our life. You know what I mean? It's only bad ways of looking at it. It's always a good day to be breathing. Unfortunately, a lot of my brothers are not. So I'm happy, I'm healthy, I feel terrific.
Tremendous. I was talking to my co-host earlier in the day, and we have decided we will not bring up WWE.
Well, that's up to you. I always tell everybody to ask me whatever they want, and of course I always answer because I'm unfiltered, as they say, but that's fine because, you know, obviously, I mean, that's not where most of my interest is, so maybe this will be different than all the interviews I've been doing lately. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Cool. So I'm going to start off. How did you get hooked up with Paul Heyman and ECW?
Well, I remember at the time I was wrestling for All Japan Pro Wrestling. I was living in Georgia, and I was doing some indies in between my trips to Japan. And Sabu was, and had been for a while, going to ECW. He was headlining the show. He was actually helping the crowd grow at the time because that was at a stage where they were just starting to do more shows, you know, a couple times a month, and the crowds were getting a little bigger and 200 people, 300 people, and it was growing, and Sabu was a huge part of that. So Paul loved Sabu. His word meant a lot, and he said, you got to bring in RVD. So Paul had called me, I remember after a while, because Sabu kept saying, did Paul call you yet? That motherfucker, he was supposed to call you on Tuesday. That happened for the longest time, and I didn't really care because I was pretty much into having the deal I had with All Japan, and I was fine. But anyway, one time Paul calls, and he wants me to go up and do a job for Mikey Whipwreck. I said, okay, but not interested. Thanks anyway. And then, because at that point, it looked like he was just going to be doing Sabu a favor. Maybe he was just going to take a look at me and see, you know, what I had. But at the time, that was in the end of 95, you know, a lot of hardcore fans, maybe Paul too, could have caught me on some tape trading, some old WCW footage from 92, South Atlantic, IWF, but, you know, I wasn't really in the spotlight at the time, so it looked like he was just going to bring me in as a meet for Mikey Whipwreck, his idea of a big push, and ended up not coming in that time. Then when I came in January of 96, I wrestled Axel Rotten, and the rest was history.
Wow.
It was all good.
Okay.
How did you get hooked up with the All Japan deal?
You know what? I enjoy telling that story. I haven't told this one in a while, but I was super green at the time because this was actually in 92, so I would have been 21 years old. I was wrestling in Florida at the time, And there was another wrestler by the name of Brady Boone, who I looked up to a lot. You know, when I was a fan, I enjoyed watching him on television, and he had a mask for a while, called himself Battle Cat in WWE. And I really looked up to him, and he was just super cool, and he was just, he helped me out. He said, Rob, you ever been to Japan? I said, no, I'd love to go. And he said, I'm going to pass your information on to Lord Blears, who's a promoter for All Japan. He's living in Hawaii. I'm gonna give you his number. I'm going to call him and tell him that you're calling, and that's what he did. And I ended up sending a tape to Lord Blears, who got me booked on my first trip of All Japan in February of 93. And I went over there for a two-week trip, and I knew that they liked me right away on my first trip there. But, man, it was rough being that far away from home, and especially being, you know, not that experimental when it comes to eating. I have a hard time sometimes being in countries where my choices are octopus testicles or jellyfish, you know, and took me a while to learn how to make that work.
Now, how was the transition from working the American Independence, then going to All Japan Pro Wrestling, where you're working with Phil LaFon and Doug Furness and others?
It was definitely a very important learning experience, which helped shape and mold my ring persona that I use today. When I first went to All Japan, I had really just learned to soften up from beating up all the guys on the indie scene. I started schooling with the Sheik in December of 89, and the Sheik trained us to be so stiff. I mean, it was all about grabbing each other, squeezing each other, taking each other down, trying to pin each other, kicking out. It was really way, way different than what they teach you in a lot of these wrestling schools. And I wouldn't have it any other way, by the way. And the Sheik, you know, was really about keeping it rough, you know, and protecting the business. And he really didn't smarten us up to any of the secrets, you know, that a lot of the schools will teach you now. So we learned that being on the road, because we were wrestling with guys that were afraid of us because we were so stiff and we were hurting people. Al Snow was one of those fortunate wrestlers to catch me my first year in the indie scene. And I remember lots of times he would say, "Ow, lighten up." So after compromising a little bit to make some of these guys a little more happy with the match, I lightened up a bit. And then when I went to All Japan, I learned that I was too light. I'd be sending in these tap roundhouse kicks to Kawada's chest. And what I didn't realize at the time was he can't sell that. If he sold that, it'd make him look bad, you know. And so he would respond by just plowing his foot into my face and seriously knocking me on my ass. I took offense to it at first. I thought he was being personal, punking me out. Looking back at it, I see that it was necessary. I learned how to really step my game up in All Japan by bringing the stiffness back to it, because that's where I learned, you know, if you don't really bring it and you know, make it match up to the standards, then it isn't even worth selling, you know, because these are big, tough guys, you know, that take a lot of abuse. And likewise, you know, I expect them to give it back to me all the same.
Fuller, you're up.
Rob, first of all, thank you for responding to my emails about doing the show. You know, I know you must get thousands of emails like that daily, so I really do appreciate it coming on Rubber Dog Radio. Thanks a bunch.
Right on, man. I've had a lot of interview requests for a while that I hadn't responded to because I didn't have a whole lot to promote or to talk about, because obviously I'm on some downtime taking a break from the road and the business and doing some inner searching, which is going well. I'm trying to get the word out on RVD-TV, which is one of my big projects now.
Great, great. Like I said, I just it's just phenomenal. You know, when I'm in Texas, and so I wasn't able, and I was getting smart to the internet wrestling scene where ECW was very popular. And I'm kind of jumping ahead here where Casey and Alex Saint were. My first thing of Rob Van Dam, and I heard stories. Believe me, I heard all these stories. You got to see RVD, man. You got to see RVD. He's doing this fucking crazy shit. He's a good worker. You know, he's just solid. There's everything about him solid. So when I first got a tape of Barely Legal from a guy in New York, me and my friend sat down and we watched, and we're seeing this stuff, and we're seeing some guys we know, and then you come on the screen, and you cut this fucking promo, or, you know, you're, you know, ramming Paul Heyman for not booking you on the show, and I'm a fucking filler and against Lance Storm, and a phenomenal match, by the way, and phenomenal performance. And then after that, we started getting, you know, then we got on the internet, we're like, we gotta get a fucking taste of this guy, man. We got to see these other matches.
You know, that's funny, that interview that you bring up, and thanks for taking me down memory lane, but that interview straight from the heart that I did at ECW's first pay-per-view was a lot like the new ECW's first pay-per-view, One Night Stand, as far as me getting on the mic and, you know, connecting straight from the heart to the crowd, you know?
Well, that, and I was going to bring that up, and KZ, I hope you don't mind. One of my major questions coming in tonight, and I had this question in my head since I knew you were going to do the interview. KZ, let me just ask this one question about WWE. When you cut that promo at One Night Stand 2005, you cut it. It was the most it was one of the best promos I've ever seen because it was from the heart. It was genuine. When you walk backstage, can you paint the scene?
Oh boy.
You know, it was nothing but respect. When I went back there, people were surprised because they didn't know that I could talk that well, because I don't get that excited trying to sell a house show for the weekend and my big, you know, match against Bobby Lashley coming up. I don't really get behind those promos too well, so I say, fuck it, you can keep those. Most people were surprised. You know, Steve Austin said to Tommy Dreamer, damn, why don't he talk like that on our show? And, you know, it was about ECW. It was about, this is the way we want to be seen. This is the real us, you know what I mean? And it was respect, and it was also, you know, a lot of the boys, I could tell they were looking at me, admiring the fact that I had the balls to go out there and say that, you know. And so it was a good thing, you know. No harm came from it, as I knew that it wouldn't, you know, because people think that I really speak without thinking, which I don't. I'm aware of everything that comes out of my mouth, and I actually do go about it in a smart way, you know. I just know I wouldn't say anything about anybody that I wouldn't say right to their face, so that's about as genuine as you can get.
Much respect to you for cutting that promo, man. Much respect.
All right, yep. So on April 20th, 1996, at Hostile City Showdown, it was you versus Sabu, who I imagine you probably worked 1,000 times up to that point, but that was the first match that really hot-started your first big angle in ECW, which was your big respect angle between Sabu and yourself. Now, how did that match compare to the other matches you'd had with Sabu before, and then how did you feel knowing that you were going to be putting this big angle?
That match actually happened on the fly. We had the match. Was this the respect match or the one leading up to it?
This was the one leading up to the respect match. It was at the Hostile City Showdown show.
Okay, so we wrestled each other, and this was really like the first really long big match I had in ECW, because really I haven't proven myself to the boys yet. You know what I mean? I came in and I wrestled Axel Rotten. I got over. Obviously, my moves are different. I'm acrobatic, whatever. And then when I wrestled Sabu, we pulled everything out, and obviously we had the chemistry and complemented each other's styles in such a way that none of the other boys could even touch it, you know? We're just there for each other. We understand each other because we have a similar vision of what we think a kick-ass match is, so that's why I always prefer wrestling somebody like that. The end of the match, I won, which really got some tension in the back, because Sabu didn't get beat by anybody. And as long as he'd been there, you know, the Eliminators and Taz and all the guys that at the time were pretty heavy egos at the time, I think they took offense to that, you know, to the fact that this new guy comes in and beats Sabu, who was the man to beat. And it was something between me and Sabu. I mean, we're brothers. I mean, he's the Sheik's nephew, and he was there, you know, since day one in the ring with me. And besides that, he was always telling me that I was better than everybody else. You know, as far as my confidence, I got to say I probably got most of that from Sabu, always keeping me in check when he was training me and telling me I was better than everybody else, you know, and that I didn't need to worry about, you know, the stuff they needed to worry about, because I was going to be a star. So it was always like that. So I beat Sabu, and then it was, you know, the crowd was still new and intimidating to me because I came up there from Georgia where you just show your dimples and clap your hands and get the crowd behind you. And now I'm in front of ECW and I have to prove myself to them, you know, and they're just waiting for me to slip so they can say, you fucked up, you know, and it was intimidating. The crowd was, you know, that's why I was like, okay, I got to have some new moves. What if I throw a chair up and spin kick it and kick it into the guy's face? Yeah, that'd be a good move. Let's see, what else can I do? And I was trying to come up with ways to up my repertoire and up my ante, up my game, you know, so that I could fit in there. And obviously in the long run, I learned how to master that style with those incredibly high standards and even raise the standards myself. So it was awesome. But this night I beat Sabu, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, I just beat him. He's the man. I'm going to go over to shake his hand and get his endorsement so he can say, you know, okay, RVD's cool. Look, everybody, I'm RVD's cool. I went over and then when I went to shake his hand, he goes, don't shake my hand. I said, what? And my heart dropped. I'm like, no, don't do this to me. They're going to fucking hate me is what I was thinking. And he sticks his hand out. He goes, don't shake it. And I was going to shake it, and I was just like, man, he better know what he's fucking doing. And I turned and walked away, and they went, boo. And honestly, I mean, it kind of hurt hearing all those boos and stuff because, you know, I wasn't that secure with what was going on there at that time, you know, being not as experienced way back then. That was, you know, 12 years ago. And then also, you know, just this new crowd and me coming in trying to prove myself. And then for him to do that, I was like, oh, no. And I didn't realize till afterwards that was money. You know, Sabu called it on the fly, led to our respect match and a series of other outstanding competitions.
Wow. Wow, that's a great story. But we're going to keep with the timeline here. As far as your program in ECW with Sabu, who was the – I hate using the term writer. Who helped book the majority of that program?
You know, a lot of what ECW was just us going out there as artists. And both bringing what we bring to the table. A lot of it really was that. It wasn't very storyline-oriented like the WWE is. And maybe more so it was for Raven or Sandman, you know, and Dreamer. They kind of did the storyline thing more. And me and Fonzie and Sabu, for the most part, you know, we'd just say, let's roll the camera and let's just cut up and you know, be fun. And we laughed our asses off. It was a great time. I mean, I'm sure you've heard everybody from the original ECW days talk about how much they loved that part of their career. We'd be doing promos anywhere from 1 in the morning till 5 in the morning after a long, long day of traveling and wrestling. And so, you know, we were drinking at the time. You know, I'd put whatever kind of pill I had in front of me in my mouth, you know, and do whatever to get me by, and they'd roll the cameras, and it was just like a big party, you know. Didn't realize until a little bit later how destructive that was, you know. But looking back at it, though, that's what was going on. And, you know, the matches would usually be set up by Paul, but even for that, for the most part, early on in the show, he would ask me, who do you want to wrestle tonight? And that's usually how it was.
Okay, I don't want to – excuse me?
Go for it, Alex.
That's my middle name, by the way.
Oh, is it?
Yes, sir.
Not Alexander, although most of the people on the internet think they're the smart fans and they think they got the info correct, and it's actually not Alexander.
Okay, well, my real name is actually Alexander, but I don't want to deviate too far from the Sabu storyline, but I do want to keep it in timeline. I don't have the date right here in front of me, but I remember a match that you worked with Mikey Whipwreck, and Brian Pillman came out and gave you a rub, per se. Now, when was that discussed, and why were you given the rub on Brian Pillman?
That, honestly, I didn't really understand that much, really, what was going on. But obviously, Paul was trying to figure out what to do with me. I don't think that I had Fonzie yet, you know, for a mouthpiece. And I think, you know, that he was considering Brian. He was trying to attach me to somebody. I was a heel at the time, and, you know, I was like just me. And I don't even know if Fonzie was managing anybody at the time, because I remember he changed from being a ref to a manager, and he was managing Taz, and then switched over to manage me and Sabu, you know, somewhere in there. But I think that was just Paul, you know, trying to feel things out, trying to figure out, you know, something that he could do with me. I have and always have had all the respect in the world for Brian Pillman, so it was an honor, you know, to be associated with him, even just for that brief moment.
David Fuller, you have a question?
Well, I'm not gonna lie. I didn't know a lot of what you did at ECW before Barely Legal, and still to this day, you know, dates and me just don't get along on a lot of things. But
that's why he sleeps alone. Then, sorry, Fuller.
Hey man,
just ribbing.
Hey man,
you can get an inflated mate and fill it up with warm air for up there on the East Coast in the cold days. He's a hot air dryer.
One of my favorite shows, one of my favorite ECW shows, and I remember reading about this on the internet, I'm kind of probably jumping the gun. One of my favorite ECW shows was WrestlePalooza 1997. And, you know, it had the big match with Dreamer and Raven, and the loser leaves town. Raven's going to WCW, everybody knows. And then this angle happens after the show. And I've never, ever, aside from one other time when you wrestled John Cena, I have never seen the crowd so just majorly shoot, I'm going to kill you, pissed off. Then
was that a New
Day? Sabu, and Lawler cleaned out the ECW locker room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was awesome. That was a good time, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
I mean,
that was awesome because obviously that was definitely making the most out of the situation. Here I was, fed up with some of what ECW was doing with me. Bischoff offered me a job with WCW, and that could have been that. I could have just left. Who knows how I would have been used in WCW. Maybe I would have been wrestling the Disco Inferno with a rubber duck on a pole match, you know? glad I didn't go that way. You know, at one time, him and DDP were talking about making me the Mortal Kombat character that they did, you know, and gosh, that would have probably put a speed bump in my career path as well. But then Paul, who knew that he had ties in with the WWE, which now we know he was getting paid by them the whole time, even though he lied to us. But anyway, he had this idea, you know, what if you jump gun, you go over there to WWE. So now I'm on WWE's television as an outsider beating WWE contracted wrestlers like Jeff Hardy, Too Cold Scorpio. And then when I got to come back to ECW, I was an outsider there because they believed that I was with WWE because obviously I had to have signed with them or I couldn't be on their television beating their wrestlers, you know. So it really put the spotlight on me. That's where Mr. Monday Night really came about. And that really launched me into like a whole new level of superstardom. It was an awesome move.
I apologize that we keep bouncing back and forth, but I do want to go over the rest of 96 and 1997, and starting with two more matches that you had with Sabu during the summer of 96, one being the respect match at, it was the match after that in Hardcore Heaven where the rope broke, and then at the Doctor Was In where you and Sabu fought a stretcher match. I want to know your two memories on those matches.
Yeah, I remember both of those. The Doctor Is In was very memorable for me for a few reasons. One, the outstanding circumstances of the night, because it was like 1 in the morning. The ring had broken a few times, and the crowd had waited patiently while they tried to fix it. They had Kimona Wanalei dancing up on top, shaking her ass, trying to keep the crowd going. It was like 101 degrees outside already. But we had all this going in, and Paul even told the people if they wanted their money back, you know, instead of waiting for the main event after like what I think was the third time the ring broke, you know, they were welcome to a refund, but everybody stayed. They wanted to see the match, and we went out there, Sabu and I, and we delivered. And even though the rope was broke and sagging, Sabu was doing the triple jump moonsault, jumping from the chair up to the top rope. I couldn't believe every time he did that he was even going for it. One of the other reasons that it's really memorable for me is the night before that, I hyperextended my knee at the Lulu Temple in a match against Chris Jericho. and
yeah.
and my leg was like really hurt pretty bad. And it was actually that same night that you mentioned that was the first time that I went out to the ring wrestling on pain meds, the very first of many, many, many nights.
Okay, then to jump ahead real quick, y'all feuded throughout the entire 1996, and then toward the end you ended up teaming together, and then you had runs against Doug Furness and Don Crawford, and then you began the tables and ladders and chairs craze when you went in your war against the Eliminators. Now, those two feuds were very different, and I would like to know your opinions on both of those tag teams and both of the different matches and different styles you had with each team.
Well, wrestling the Eliminators, you know, was basically a very hardcore team wrestling another very hardcore team. I mean, Perry Saturn and John Cronus didn't mind doing anything. I mean, they had all kinds of crazy ideas. You know, they wanted to suplex the ladder off the top rope onto us and all kinds. I mean, they wanted to go, you know, and Cronus, too. You know, he was very impressive and... He, you know, both of those guys didn't mind getting bloody, you know, fighting with the steel, the metal of the ladders and the chairs. And we knew that was a battle because we also fought, you know, to outshine the other team a lot. You know, there was always that behind the scenes, you know, control drama that we had going on with those matches where, you know, where we both wanted to make sure that the other team wasn't, you know, making us look too bad. You know, we had that kind of pride. With Furness and Crawford, that was straight up out of All Japan. You know, I'd wrestled those guys many times in All Japan, and now that they were here in ECW, it was like us introducing the style to them, showing them, you know, this is awesome, you're going to love ECW, you know, and actually, you know, like feeding them some ideas beforehand of how they could how they could fit in, because a lot of people were intimidated by it and they thought, oh no, I'm not going to do all that barbed wire stuff. No, you don't have to. You know, everybody had like their own niche and drew, you know, like their own favoritism from the crowds, you know, from Sandman to Raven to the gangsters. You know, there was guys like Lance Storm that were extreme just because they were so talented, you know, and Jerry Lynn, and then there was other guys like Balls Mahoney, you know, that were extreme in totally different ways, and it was all about, you know, bringing all that together to have and put on the best show in professional wrestling.
I do have a question about Furness and LaFon. Your personal feelings on them as a team. I'm disappointed that they didn't get the respect that they deserved and earned as far as working up in New York. When they first came in, they had some fire burner matches, and when they got hooked up with Bulldog and Hart, or Bulldog and Owen, those matches were amazing. But what are your feelings on Furness and LaFon not getting the proper respect that they have earned and deserved?
Well, I mean, they were both very accomplished and very good wrestlers. At the time when they came to the United States to wrestle for WWE, they had already been tagging for over 8 years together in All Japan Pro Wrestling. And, you know, Crawford, we used to call him the master. That's what Abdullah the Butcher would call him, the master, because he had a brain for storytelling, and he would just come up with these great ideas, you know. And in fact, I had a singles match with Danny Crawford, who's also Phil LaFont, same guy, over there in Japan at the Budokan. That was like a huge pivotal moment in my career. It was one of those matches that elevated me from you know, from being an under guy, you know, up to being an over guy, you know. And it was just one particular match. It was the first time they gave me a chance to have a singles match at the Budokan, which was the big show. It used to be in front of 17,000 people, and it was for the championship, a junior heavyweight championship, which I never wanted the junior title. I went my whole career staying away from that so I wouldn't be labeled as a junior. But for a short amount of time in All Japan, I was challenging for it. And it just, you know, happened to be I was putting on the best matches with those guys anyway. So I really didn't want to win the match, but what a great learning experience it was for me, though, working with Phil LaFont. When they were in WWE, you know, they were just portrayed as foreigners that are heels, and that's boring for anybody, you know. I mean, the Russo brothers, the, you know, whenever they do something like that, the French-Canadian guys or whatever, I mean, there's really only so much to that. It kind of labels you and stereotypes you as a spot that where you're just kind of filling up a spot on the card as the guys, you know, that people can chant USA, USA at, you know. So I also know that they were told to tone it down, you know, because they worked their asses off when they first got there because that's how you do it in Japan. And they were having, you know, kick-ass great matches at every single house show until the agents told them, you know, to slow it down and it wasn't necessary. Could have had something to do with that too.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make because I saw them in house show matches and they were just tearing it down, you know, going 25 yep. solid, you know, and just, you know, stuff that I've only seen on tape because honestly, I have not seen I was not able to see the ECW product live because I'm in the West Coast, but I still followed it. I still got the tapes and it was just an amazing feeling to see these guys.
Are one of you guys on the phone in Texas and one of you on the West Coast?
Two of us are in the West Coast.
Sweet. Where at?
I'm outside San Francisco, and Alex is in San Diego.
Nice. I'll be in San Francisco at the WonderCon next month.
Tremendous. That's cool. I may have to hit that, depending on, is it February?
February 23rd and 24th, I believe.
Okay, and that's at Moscone Center, if I remember right.
Yep, and I'll definitely have a camera, be filming some RVD TV while I'm there.
Cool,
awesome.
Cool.
Okay,
right,
then you go. Okay, and then, so you had the long run of matches against the Eliminators and Coffin and Furnace and then the Gangsters even. And then after that, was there any, what were the plans with you? Because as we've already covered, you were a last-minute substitute for Scandito after he had injured his arm in that match against Lance Storm. So was there any plans to involve you in anything? And then when were you let know that you were going to be working with Storm at the first pay-per-view?
You know, that's a question that when I get asked a lot, I usually don't know the answer. If somebody else had plans for me, I don't know. I mean, I've never really been one that to sit in on booking meetings. You know, those are usually for the guys on top to bury everybody underneath them that they're trying to hold their heads underwater, you know. In ECW, because I cared a lot, I would talk with Paul and discuss things, and because Sabu, you know, was my partner for a lot of that, I would know a lot what was going on when Sabu would be talking to Paul as well, you know, but you adjust, you know. I don't know, we moved forward, you know. Sabu and I were tagging. We were tag team champions, so we had all the gold. And then he also had his thing with Taz, you know, that was kind of like a solo thing, you know. And it was that night, of course, which I'm sure you're going to get around to, when I wrestled Bam Bam Bigelow for the television title. And at the time, Sabu and I were very tight. We were still partners because the whole storyline going into that was Fonzie set the match up so I could soften Bam Bam up. Sabu had a championship match with him like the following weekend, but I beat Bam Bam and I won the television title from him that night. And what I didn't realize, when you talk about those pivotal moments, which we've almost covered all of them up till this point, that was the pivotal moment of my career up till that point. I had no idea what had just happened. It was the next show after that Buffalo moment in history when I was at Queens, New York, and I was wrestling Mikey Whipwreck again, and I just had, you know, some ideas because I was always trying to outdo myself in ECW because that's what the whole spirit was about, you know. So I'd be excited just trying to come up with moves that topped moves that I'd done before. And I remember before the show at Queens, after I just won the television title, because, you know, I didn't, you know, it was a match, big deal. But I told Paul, I said, man, I got this thing I want to do with Mikey. I want to crotch him on this guardrail, but I want to jump from the other guardrail, and I want to jump all the way across, you know, the walkway here and do a spin kick and kick him into the crowd. And I was just looking for Paul, you know, to say, wow, you can do that, or give me some kind of encouragement. And he looks at me, and he goes, it's not going to matter what you do tonight. I said, what? He goes, it's not going to matter what you do tonight. He said, you can do no wrong. Tonight, those people are going to love you. everything you do was just going to be huge to them. And I really didn't know, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And he was right. I went through those curtains, and that was like the first time I'd ever felt all those fans behind me, you know, appreciating me for being their champion. It was really special. I mean, it really put me up higher on a level, you know, that of course I never came back down from. I just kept moving forward after that and held that and defended that television title for 23 months after I won it. You know, that dive that I did out to the crowd during that match, two times, people remember that, you know, people remember that it was historical. I remember it, and, you know, thank God for DVDs. And, boy, I sure felt all of the energy from the crowd after that every time I came out there.
Was there any heat between you and Sabu? Because Sabu was one of the guys that they had really put the company on his back, and he carried it for a while. But then after that match in particular with you and Bam Bam Bigelow, like you just said, you cut a lot of steam really fast for being one of the top heels, one of the top, you know, baby faces. And was there any heat between you and Sabu? Because after that, Sabu wasn't really as much featured as you were to that point.
You know, Sabu and I are like family, and he has my best interest at heart, you know. So he's always looking out for me, and he would only be happy in a situation, you know, where I'm getting some attention. He even, one time when we were in All Japan, we wrestled each other, and this was in 97, and the office gave the finish to him that he was up, and I didn't even know. He just felt like it was the wrong thing because now I was a star, you know, and I was getting, you know, the really good reactions from the crowd, and you know, things were different, and he just didn't feel like it was right, you know, that he was going over. So he actually actually swerved me. And I didn't know, but he told me that I was going over, you know, and we actually, and I actually thought that came down from the office. I didn't find out till later that he and I had gone against the office's direction.
Oh, wow.
That's an interesting story.
I have a question and a statement.
Sure.
My statement is I broke into wrestling in 1998, and when I broke in, Rob, I broke down here in Texas. And I broke in around the same time that Red Dog, Rodney Bonneau, Rodney Mack, and Jazz had just broken in. And then Jazz had went at ECW. And so I had been watching you. And then, you know, every week Jazz would come back. And, hanging out RVD, man. Fucking cool, man. But
yeah, Red Dog and Jazz are some hard-working folks. You know, I got a lot of respect for them. I'd like to see them someday get a good payoff for all their hard work.
They are. They're two wonderful people, and, you know, we became really close. But so, you know, we would start watching a lot more ECW because they were on there, and we knew them. And it's different when you know somebody on there. And so when I was breaking into the business and I wanted to learn how to work, I'm watching some old stuff. But when I want to pop a crowd, and when I want to give them that moment that makes my match different from everybody else's, I was watching nothing but RVD matches. And I watched that match with Bam Bam Bigelow, and I said, I don't care how I got to do it. If I die doing it, I've got to do that fucking thing he did out on the floor. It just amazed me. And, you know, no one ever gets enough appreciation, especially a guy like you. Never get enough appreciation, but As a wrestling fan who was just excited, when you get bored with the normal entertainment shit, man, and you just want to be wild, you made it so much fun to be a wrestling fan after it had been taken away for so long with all the gimmicks. You made it so much fun to be a wrestling fan again, and you should be commended for that. I don't think you get appreciated enough. So you were a big part of a little guy like me breaking into the business.
Oh.
And then my question is, I'm fast-forwarding again, jumping the gun, but one of my favorite matches is Heat Wave, 98, you and Sabu, Shinseki Hayabusa. Man, tell us the story behind that match, because it was phenomenal.
That was an awesome match, you know, for us, too, in Dayton, Ohio, on a pay-per-view. And that was the first time I had wrestled either one of those Japanese wrestlers. And, you know, of course, ECW had the reputation, so they knew that it was going to be a crazy match. And we just had, like, all kinds of ideas. Didn't know what kind of order any of that was going to go down. But Sabu and I had been tagging long enough to where we had our double team moves, you know, and were able to pull them out and on the draw. And, you know, they brought a lot to the table, too. It was an awesome classic match. One of those matches I say thank God for DVD, because that's definitely one to be proud of.
Definitely.
Okay.
Can we wrap this up pretty soon, guys?
Actually, you want to wrap it up now? We can wrap it up now.
Yeah, unless you guys don't have any other questions. That's cool.
Oh, we have plenty.
Oh, okay.
But now, the question is, how much time do you have, Rob?
How about we do like about about 8 minutes or so?
Okay, cool. That would work.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we're gonna just skip everything you've done, and we're just going to talk to you, Rob.
Here I am.
What was your favorite ECW match to perform in?
My matches with Jerry Lynn, because there was just a lot to that. You know, I got a lot out of that personally. My motivation was to entertain the crowd, you know, but I entertain the crowd by entertaining myself, you know, and that's really what it's all about. Jerry and I both brought something out of each other that nobody else brought out of us, you know, a whole new level of competition, and I saw that in him, you know, right off the bat, the first time I wrestled him, and I just really enjoyed the physical competitiveness of our matches. You know, it's an exhibition, but we really challenged each other and challenged ourselves at the same time. The crowning moment, of course, was winning the world title from John Cena in the new ECW, if you want to call it that. And that was
no.
Totally different. That was it was a great match, but it was a great crowd. The crowd was one of a kind, incredible, 100% for everything I stood for, 100% against everything that Cena stood for. That could never be replaced. That moment could never, ever be replaced with any other moment in history. So as far as that goes, that was the shit. But for fun, for what I get out of a match, you know, and for showcasing, and if I wanted to show somebody just one match out of my whole career to show them, look, this is what I do, I'd want them to see RVD versus Jerry Lynn.
All right. Well, what we're gonna do is we're gonna wrap it up, but I would love to have you back on the show, Rob.
Okay, awesome.
It was,
definitely
a pleasure. Before we let you go, I'm gonna give you the office. I would like for you to explain to my listeners out there what RVD TV is.
Yes, and I appreciate that. RVD TV is an online weekly episode program that's at robvandam.com. It is for members. You can go and look at the preview page and see what the some of the previews of the shows. You'll get an idea of what we're doing right away. This is me. This is my real life. I don't know if anybody like reads my interviews or hears my interviews, or if they read my blogs, they'll see that I have a lot more to say than whatever or cool, like the WWE would script for me for that two-dimensional character you could see on television. Now with RVD TV, this is the real me. This is inviting you into my house, into my, you know, into my backyard, here with my family, hanging out with my friends. In my gym, working out, and it's all really good stuff. I live in Los Angeles. I have a lot of friends that also have their own fan bases, so I have a lot of cameos from other celebs on RVD TV. It's only been on for 4 weeks right now, and every Friday a new episode comes out. Once the episode comes out, it goes in the archives, so you haven't missed the last few episodes. They're still in there. You can see five episodes, six episodes comes out tomorrow. Tomorrow's episode is going to be Language Censorship. This is a reoccurring episode I call Friends in High Places, which is inspired by real-life conversations I have with friends of mine or with family all the time. It's like sometimes it's intellectual, sometimes it's just funny, but a lot of times I catch myself talking with people about things like, you know, what do you think about the death penalty? You know, how are your feelings on that? Or, you know, what about, you know, how do you feel about the Bible? You know, I mean, this is like brave shit to talk about, you know, for a celebrity to state their honest, true feelings on something. They really take a chance on alienating a lot of other fans, you know. I don't want to do that, and I don't want everyone to agree with me, but I just want to inspire people to think. So with Friends in High Places, we pick a subject, and we talk about it. The subject that we did on the first one, it was myself and Chris Masters with Justin McCauley, who's a UFC mixed martial artist in Team Punishment. We're talking about gun control. The program that comes out tomorrow is Language Censorship with myself, one of my Hollywood agents, and Taboo from Black Eyed Peas, who's a good friend of mine. And I got to say, this is one of my favorite episodes so far because I legitimately have problems with censorship. I don't get it. I don't understand. We invented these words to describe things that we talk about, and we invent two sets of words, one that's okay and then one that's not okay. Why do we give that power to that word? I can never understand it. If, you know, if you say, hey, you know, you're a great fucking guy, why am I supposed to be offended by that? Obviously, you didn't mean to offend, but just because the F word was used, I'm supposed to be brainwashed to be offended. You know, it's like just a source for negative energy. And actually, I'm talking it out with some of my friends in high places, and Taboo actually brought up a good point or two. And this is something that will continue. It's every Friday, so there's like a new my workouts, actual real-time workouts you can work out with me or see what I'm doing. Those will be on there like once a month, Friends in High Places episode once a month. We're talking about going for it. You know, you were mentioning jumping off the top rope out into that crowd in Buffalo and just, you know, the balls it takes to go for it. How many people go to a comedy show and they say, I could get up there on stage, you know, sometime on amateur night, maybe I'll go up there, come up with some jokes. I did that a while ago. I did that like last month. I got it on tape. And then a couple weeks ago, I saw a good friend of mine, Jay Moore, from, you know, he's a comedian from Last Comic Standing and Ghost Whisperer. Big A-level dude. He brought me up on stage, and I did a 10-minute set of stand-up, and I got myself, I got him, I got his beautiful wife, Nikki Cox, all filmed for a future episode of RVD TV. So there's a lot of variety on there. It's a lot of fun, and I hope everyone will check it out at robvandam.com. And I also have a myspace.com/5starcomics.
Tremendous.
And
Tremendous.
I did catch a preview of that RVD TV, and it is really, really fucking cool. If you're a fan of RVD or just a fan of just some really cool entertaining TV and thoughts and stuff and discussion, I'd urge you to get it. It's really cool.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I've got like I've got a lot of famous friends too. I'm already looking forward to filming my friend Jerry Manthe, who's from Surreal Life, Playboy, and Survivor. And we're going to film something with my friend that's from Stargate and Star Trek. Fans aren't going to believe it. They're going to be like, these are the guys that RVD hangs out with? But I just I know a lot of people. I got Sin Dog from Cypress Hill and the Reyes Brothers. We're talking about nothing other than marijuana prohibition and how fucked up that is. So we're really putting our balls out there, you know, dropping our pants, saying this is the real us. Take a look at it. One of the coolest comments I got on the message board was, holy shit, Chris Masters just got really cool. That's because we get to show the real us. Yeah, that was awesome.
Oh, boy.
That's what it's all about.
All right.
Right
well,
on,
Rob,
guys. Appreciate you helping me get the word out on RVD TV. Appreciate the interview, and definitely we'll do it again, man. Just hit me up.
Thanks for your time,
thanks,
brother.
Rob.
It was definitely my pleasure.
Good luck with the show, guys.
Thanks, brother. We'll talk
watch
to you
Brock
soon. Watch Brock Lesnar. He's right. I have to
damn
agree
right
with Rob on that one. Okay. All righty. Caller from the 682. Whom am I speaking with?
It's Chris Wolf.
Oh.
Hey.
Man.
What's up, Wolfie?
Jesus Christ, man. You already cut me off from RVD, so I'm totally – my markout moment is gone.
Hey, man. I watched some of your shit today.
No
you
shit.
And, yeah. I got a box from Fuller today, and I opened it up and I was watching some of your stuff. Pretty wacky,
so,
man.
Well, pretty wacky, he says.
Well,
ask
I mean,
Alex.
What did you think? I mean, you know, did you like what you saw? Was it entertaining? Was it something that
well, yeah,
you smoke weed with?
Of course,
at?
I was entertained. Well, you know, I was laughing at your skinny ass.
It's our life's work, man. It's our fucking life's work, man. Jesus Christ, when we die, that's all we have.
It ain't much, but that's all we have.
That's all we have, man. I mean, Wolf's got a kid on the way. I mean, I don't, but I mean, Wolf's got a kid on the way, so.
Well, you know, Dave, you have to get laid to have a kid to come.
Hey, man, I don't have a problem getting, ask Wolf. I don't have a problem
with
doing that.
With a woman.
Shut up. I don't have a problem doing that. Just ask Wolf about the people over the house. Ask Wolf about the phone calls he gets from me every other day.
Hey, man, this guy's he's a man whore. I don't know what to, you know. He's merely my brother-in-law. He's not blood related. Jesus Christ.
Oh, man. Okay. Well.
Awesome.
Alex, you're gonna run the show, dude. I have to go across the street and vote. It is Proposition 420.
Okay. Well, what time is Michael Coughlin coming on?
Well, apparently that's for him to know and us to find out, Alex. But we can run this shit. All right, we got Chris Wolf on the line. Alex Saint, real quick, we got UFC 81 coming up this Saturday night, and I know everyone is looking forward to Brock Lesnar, Frank Mir. Alex, let me get your thoughts, and Wolf, you too. You're Brock Lesnar coming into Saturday's fight. It's your second MMA fight, but it's your first real one because it's UFC, it's the big lights, it's pay-per-view. You're going against Frank Mir. Are you looking for the quick win to put all the naysayers to shame? What do you do, Alex? You go first.
Well, I saw Brock Lesnar's first fight in Los Angeles when he fought. I can't think of the guy's name off the top of my head, but I knew he competed in the Olympics in judo. So the guy, I mean, he wasn't a well-known name, but maybe he wasn't one of the top tier guys, but he was definitely a challenge for Brock Lesnar because you got to understand that was Brock Lesnar's first ever mixed martial arts fight.
Exactly.
And, he had trained for someone else that entire time. He had trained for Hongman Choi, and then he ended up getting a replacement. And then Brock really looked really, really impressive in that. He passed the guy's guard and showed really effective ground and pound. Brock Lesnar, we're going to go into this a lot with Michael Coughlin in the second hour, so I don't want to go too much in detail. But
sure.
I definitely think that Frank Mir has the skill to beat Brock Lesnar. But Brock Lesnar is a huge undercard because we don't exactly know what Brock Lesnar brings to the table. We know what he brought to the table. He has amazing wrestling ability. But Brock Lesnar's also been training with many different camps over the past 2 years. And so the Brock Lesnar that we get this Saturday night is not going to be a Brock Lesnar that anyone's seen. So it's really a toss-up. But, I mean, I'd have to give it to Lesnar just based on the fact that Frank Mir has really been unimpressive lately in UFC.
Chris Wolf.
Yeah, Saint hit it right on the head with the, I mean, maybe 2-3 years ago, Frank Mir, I mean, still Frank Mir is a freak. I mean, his jiu-jitsu was fucking awesome. Before this motorcycle accident, I give it to Frank Mir, no problem. But Lesnar's such a freak, man. I mean, you look at this guy and even still, I mean, it's obviously he's off the steroids or juice or whatever the fuck you want to call it because he's jacked now, but he's not as shredded as he used to be. But like Saint said, I mean, you really don't know what you're going to see with Lesnar, but he's such a freak, man. I mean, you know, he's going to look for the shoot early on and try to ground and pound or go for the submission with Mir. I mean, going in, I mean, I won't be surprised either way who wins. I wouldn't, you know, I'm not going to put it past Mir because, like I said, his jiu-jitsu is really good, but. I mean, but Lesnar's such a freak, man. I'm really looking forward to the fight.
One more quick question, and I know you're going to get into this in the second hour, Mike Coughlin, and this is really for Chris Wolf. I know, Alex, you're going to take the second hour here in a minute, and you're going to cut me off. Wolf, you're Dana White. The heavyweight division is floundering. Randy Couture did what he needed to do. You got the Tim Sylvia fight this Saturday. Are you looking to watch this Brock Lesnar fight, and maybe if it goes the way it goes with all this money, promotion, PR, marketing, do you hang your hat on Brock Lesnar in the heavyweight division as your shining knight if he goes in and destroys Frank Mir?
I think Dana's already banking on – I think right now he's praying to God that Brock Lesnar destroys Frank Mir on Saturday night. I mean – Right now he's got Sylvia versus Big Nog in for the interim title, and he's playing. If I'm Dana White, I don't know who I want to win that fight because everybody in the MMA community is just absolutely bored to tears by Tim Sylvia. I think he definitely wants Brock Lesnar to go in there and destroy Frank Mir, and he wants, you know, he wants to build. I definitely think he wants to build the heavyweight division around Brock Lesnar.
Hey, Alex, real quick, you want to hear a Necro Butcher story?
Oh, definitely. I always love Necro Butcher stories.
All right, man. Me and Wolf and I should say, we go down to Mineral Wells. And there's a little fucking hick town called Mineral Wells, about an hour and a half from Fort Worth. They have this little fucking show. And so we pick up Necro and a guy named J. Diego. So we pick them motherfuckers up. They come up here and stay with my folks and Wolf and I. We pick these motherfuckers up. All the way
I know where the story's going.
All the way back, motherfucker Necro says, we got to stop and get beer, motherfucker. We got to stop and get beer, motherfucker. So anyway, so we stop off and they get beer. Necro buys, what, a 24-pack or
something,
two 24-packs? Okay, so anyway, he buys two 24-packs, one's for everybody else, the other one's just for him. So motherfucker comes back up to our house. He's done gone through nearly all of his beer. So he staggered around. He's like, where's the goddamn bathroom? I'm like, right around the corner, man. All right. Motherfucker, he shuts the door, and he's like, you hear this grunting noise. But you don't hear nothing hitting the water. So I'm like, oh, shit. he opens the window. He goes, hey, guys, I'm going to piss in the cat's fucking litter box. So I'm like, don't you dare, motherfucker. And I go to get up, and I hear the piss hitting the litter. I said, you got to be shitting me. He pissed in my cat's litter box. And he's laughing his ass. He's like, ha, 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 ha. Oh, let's can't go piss now. Ha, ha, ha. Motherfucker stumbles out of the bedroom, sits down on the couch. Fucking, I forget what we were doing, Wolf. I think we were watching some really bad wrestling, and we fell asleep. And then there was another time we all went down to his house, Wolf I and another guy by the name of Balls Ryder, and we all went down there, and Necro, as soon as we got there, his wife and kids were gone, his ex-wife now, his wife and kids were gone at the time. He's like, we got to go to Walmart. And we said, why the fuck for? We got to get a pie. I shit you not, he's telling us this. We're like, what the fuck? So he drives us out to Walmart at 2 o'clock in the fucking morning in Killeen, Texas. House smells like piss and vinegar. So, go to fucking Walmart. Motherfucker's tiptoeing around like a little girl. Tiptoeing around. He's looking at all the pies. He's like, he grabs an apple pie. We're getting this one. So, we're like, okay, can we go now? We're fucking tired. It's 2 a.m. Well, we'll go back and play BPW, Merchant Pro Wrestling, on 64. We were playing that. So, then he runs and goes, no, we need one more thing. We need fucking milk. So, we went to Walmart at 2 o'clock in the morning in Killeen, Texas, with the Necro Butcher for a fucking jug of milk and an apple pie.
Yeah, mind you, I had to pay for it all, too.
And then the next day, Alex, the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning, I started work for RF Video in the pro wrestling shop here in Grapevine, Texas, and they ran their store to Grapevine Mills Mall. So my first day of work, and I'm fucking up at 2 o'clock in the morning in Killeen, Texas, hanging out with the Necro Butcher.
So what became of the apple pie and the jug of milk?
I don't know, man. I mean, he would get these urges. He was he's an odd duck. I love him to death. He's an odd duck, but he would just, once something was in his head, he was doing it. He could talk you into doing anything. Ask Wolf. He could talk you into doing anything in the world. And then he would convince you it's a good reason. Hey, man, why don't you stick it down your testicles? What the fuck for? Oh, man, then he convinced you it's a good idea. I mean, and another story, while we're on the subject of Feinstein, ECW comes to Dallas. ECW comes to Dallas in 2000 at the Bronco Bowl. And Jazz had called Wolf and I up the night before. She goes, y'all want tickets? And we said, sure, we weren't going to go. She wanted all the tickets? I said, okay, sure. So she leaves them at the door. So I had to work day shift at RF that day. So I'm working. Never got any fucking business. They got business twice, the day of ECW and the day of Fully Loaded in Dallas. So anyway, there's a few people coming up, marking out. So all of a sudden, I'm getting ready to end my shift. I worked a match the night before, an indie show, with Wolf. We worked a match. And Wolf put a staple gun in my head and staples my head. And I had a big fucking gash on my forehead. So Feinstein comes up, and he looks at me. He goes, "Hey, man, I'm Rob Feinstein." I said, "Oh, I'm David Fuller. Nice to meet you." And he said, "I like that gig, Mark." He said, "Are you a worker?" He said, "You a worker?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, that's pretty cool, man." And he hung around the shop a little bit. And he got to the show that night. And he saw me afterwards. He's like, "Hey, Dave, what's going on, man?" And he's like, you know, kind of getting all close to me. And I'm like, "No, I'm kidding." But
you can pass for 12, dude.
Hey, man, back then I had long hair. You couldn't ask Wolf. There wasn't a fucking speck of facial hair on me.
Still isn't, you prick.
Fuck you, motherfucker.
That's glue on.
Yeah.
But
hey, man.
Now, Fuller, your time's over with. I appreciate you coming on. And, you know, I'm going to tell the listeners the truth. This is a shoot, brother. David Fuller was the one that booked RVD for tonight's show, and I got to put you over. Thank you for getting Rob on the show.
Well, not a problem, KZ. I love this show. I love Rubber Guard Radio. And as I told you this week, Rob was exceptionally nice in getting back to me in the emails. And I think if you didn't listen to Rubber Guard Radio before, listen to this now and listen to every show thereafter. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to line up more big guests. You know, this is going to be the radio show to listen to for wrestling, MMA, everything else. This is the show. So don't let anybody fool you. This is the show. RVD was tonight. I'm working on some other stuff coming up. For Rubber Guard, thank you, gentlemen, for having me. Wolf, I know you feel the same. I know you love this show.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a pleasure being on this week, last week. Anytime you guys want me to come on, break down some wrestling, MMA, whatever, I'm here at your disposal. I have an opinion. I'm not afraid to use it, damn it.
Tremendous, tremendous.
Real quick,
Wolf,
real quick.
Thanks for calling in, brother.
Bring your David Fuller t-shirt. Did you get yours? Does it fit?
It does fit. And I love the skull in the State of Texas outline, dude. That is badass.
Well, I appreciate that.
That is badass.
That. And you're going to try to make IHW 10 Years Later Banquet, correct?
I will do my best to fly out for that one.
Okay. All right.
And of course, all right. Of course, you put me on the spot on the radio, on the air, motherfucker. You're a dick. But
hey, man,
David, I will talk to you soon, Mr. Wolf. I appreciate you calling in again, brother.
Absolutely. Look forward to talking to you in the future.
Cool.
Enjoy Saturday
all right,
night,
Alex.
UFC.
That's right, UFC.
Thank
Speaking
y'all.
Of, I have Coughlin waiting on the line, so I'm going to hang up on Mr. Wolf and Alex. I need you to get rid of Mr. Fuller, and we'll get Coughlin on here.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Coughlin. Mike.
Yes, it's me. I'm here.
Mr. Coughlin, welcome to Rubber Guard. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing all right. How are you guys doing?
Oh, I'm really fired up, man. We just had a great interview with Rob Van Dam. And, oh, boy, we're ready to go.
Excellent.
I have my co-host on the other line, Alex Saint, also known as Alex Goff.
Of course.
Say hi,
What's
Alex.
Going on, Mr. Coughlin?
Hey, Alex, how you doing?
Yeah, doing all right.
Excellent.
Okay, well, let's get right to business. What about this Yama bullshit, Mike? What do you know about it?
I know that Bob Meyerowitz is going to probably lose a lot of money. I think that the only hook that this promotion has is that this is the original UFC promoter. Other than that, I don't know what financial resources they have. I don't know what television they have. As far as I'm concerned, this is just another promotion that will burn through a lot of capital really quick, and in about a year or two, realize that they're not making any money and that people don't want to watch MMA, they want to watch UFC, and I suspect that they're going to learn this lesson the hard way.
So what you're telling me, Mr. Yeah. Coughlin, is that a million people won't buy a pay-per-view to see this new and innovating fighting service the Yama people will fight on and what Yama actually stands for.
Well, if they think people are... Yeah. I don't know, yet another mixed martial arts group is what I think somebody once termed it as. I don't know if anybody's going to pay money to see a surface, seeing as how whatever the commercial they run will probably show the surface in full view. And after that, I don't know what it is. Although, I have a suspicion that it's something similar to what Frank Shamrock was pushing many years ago, which is kind of like if you took like like a cereal bowl, that's kind of what they fight in. It's kind of like a rounded cage almost. So you don't have the advantage of pinning a guy against a cage, but it keeps a continuous flow of action.
Oh, wow. Did you see that new – did you see the cage in Matt Hughes' new gym? They couldn't fight in something like that?
Well, I think that Matt Hughes – well, I did see the cage that Hughes had. It was kind of a – I think that was just kind of an all-purpose cage. He had a space that he had to fit in, and he purposely put in a few corners here and there so that if guys wanted to train at different angles, you'd get inside of the octagon, they could do so. But I think he was mostly just having the cage in there just so they could have a cage because – and it is important, and guys have to learn to train it. You can see what's happening to some of the guys from Pride who come over to the UFC. You're not used to the angles that the cage presents. You're not used to the feel – that it can give against the back of your neck and your lower body if you're getting taken down, it is an adjustment. So I think that you're going to see more of these guys using the cage. And if you think about it, how it relates to Meyerowitz's Yama promotion, most people are going to either train for a cage or for a ring. If you're developing some new surface that is totally unique and different, if people want to fight in this promotion, they're going to have to learn how to train with this thing, which means they're going to have to build their own thing. And if you're opening up a mixed martial arts gym, are you going to build a ring, a cage, or mystery surface that Bob Meyerowitz is pushing?
Okay, so I listened to your 5-star radio show today, and then you didn't seem too excited about the fights that are scheduled to air on the show. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, Mr. Coughlin?
Sorry, could you guys say that one more time? I didn't hear you.
Okay, I listened to your radio show today, and then you said you weren't too excited about the fights that are scheduled to air on the pay-per-view. Can you elaborate on why you think some of the matches were selected? Because why Marquardt Horn is going to be on the live show and not the Tyson Griffin fight is beyond me. So do you have any idea why the fights that were chosen were chosen?
Well, I mean, obviously your two main events make total sense. Nogueira and Sylvia and Mir and Lesnar have to be on. I think that those could both be very boring. Nogueira is obviously one of the most exciting heavyweights in sports ever seen, but Tim Sylvia is just an incredibly dull fighter. I mean, this isn't taken away from his talent. He's very talented. He's very good at being Tim Sylvia, but his fights are not always exciting to watch. Frank Mir, if he gasses out, his fights can be very boring. If you saw his fight against Dan Christensen, that was hardly setting the world on fire. And Lesnar is a power wrestler. Wrestlers, by their nature, tend to have more boring fights. You get a wrestler who's inexperienced, maybe a little tentative as the fight wears on, particularly someone like Lesnar, who does have that athletic background, which will... When you get to that third round, I think Brock Lesnar's going to be thinking, it's time to win more than win spectacular, and he'll just kind of write out the decision to the clock. And meanwhile, in the undercard fights, I mean, Mark Hart and Jeremy Horn, anything could be good, and maybe these guys will go out there and they'll have some sort of grappling contest a la Sakuraba and Carlos Newton from Pride 3. My suspicion is that it won't be. Both are very methodical fighters, to be generous. And Ricardo Almeida was scheduled to be taking on Alan Belcher. Belcher has since had to drop out with the flu, so I'm thinking they may drop Almeida's fight off the main card and slot in the Tyson Griffin bout, which to me would just make the show. I mean, I can tell anybody listening right now, if you see the name Tyson Griffin on a UFC show, you are almost assured that you're going to see one of the best fights you've ever seen in your life. The man is just a phenom when it comes to having great fights, and he's an incredible talent as well. He's got all the talent in the world to be a real true contender to 155 pounds, but as far as pound for pound most exciting fighters out there, Tyson Griffin matches up there with anyone.
Would that be a 5-star lock?
I won't say that Tyson Griffin versus Gleison Tebow is a 5-star lock for an awesome fight, but it approaches that level. This is not quite if you were to have Tyson Griffin and Roger Huerta, that would be a 5-star lock for awesome fights. Gleison Tebow, he's a very good jiu-jitsu practitioner. I've seen him fight a few times since he lost to the great Nick Diaz, of course. But he gave Nick a run for his money. His guard is very active. He throws some decent kimuras from the bottom. And I think that he could be a challenge for Tyson Griffin. But at the same time, Griffin has that incredible pedigree. I mean, trained under Cesar Gracie and Jake Shields with Gilbert Melendez and the Diaz brothers for many years. And then he since moved to Extreme Couture. And anytime you got Randy Couture in your camp, you're guaranteed you have somebody kind of knows what he's doing there. So I think Tyson Griffin is a little too much for Gleison Tebow, but Gleason's a good fighter, but he's somebody that Tyson Griffin should run over. And because of that, sometimes when guys are just a little bit better than the other one and it's not an even fight, the fight can be a little more boring because it can verge on one-sidedness.
Now, me and you both watched the live Brock Lesnar debut in Los Angeles, and then Lesnar, he's had a lot of time to train after that. And then Frank Mir from All Access Special seems like he's been training real hard. Now, what are the odds that we'll see a repeat and Lesnar will just mow through Frank Mir? And then how much of the All Access do you think was taking a little bit of liberties? How hard do you think Frank Mir is really training for this fight?
I'm not sure of how hard Frank Mir is training for this fight. I never know with him. But I will say that when I watched the All Access, I was very impressed by Frank Mir. And I always am when I hear him speak. Frank Mir is one of the most articulate, intelligent fighters in the sport. I think that his color commentary work with the WBC is as good as you're going to find. He's very good at explaining everything to your casual fan. I'd love to see him doing more color work on a UFC pay-per-view or any kind of UFC telecast. What really impressed me, and if I was Brock Lesnar, I'd be a little nervous, is that Frank specifically brought in world-class wrestlers. I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he's representing the United States in the 2000 Olympics. He brought him in to train, not so that he could get his wrestling better, because Frank has readily admitted that he's not going to stop Brock's takedown, but he wanted to see what it would be like to be in there with someone who has a pure wrestling background so that Frank could dissect what a wrestler's mentality would be. What is a wrestler's instinct going to tell him to do? And I was really impressed that Frank was doing that. I mean, that's the kind of intelligence that Frank shows. And I think for the first 3 minutes of this fight, it's going to be really cool. I'm going to really look forward to watching it. I think that everybody who watches this fight should watch very carefully because it may look like nothing's going on, but there's going to be a lot of stuff, particularly Frank. Frank Mir, watch his eyes. Frank doesn't panic in fights. He's very calm, very relaxed. But at the same time, the man just doesn't train very hard, and I suspect that he'll gas after the first round. In fact, I've never really seen Frank Mir go past one round in any kind of shape. I mean, we fought Roberto Treven, he tapped him out quick. Pete Williams got tapped out quick. Tank Abbott got tapped out quick. Wes Sims, I mean, Frank Mir gassed horribly against Wes Sims in their second fight. He tapped out Tim Sylvia in under 2 minutes. Dan Christensen, that was just an ugly fight once Frank was tired as hell. So Frank, he's a veteran. He's been around for a while. He should know how to train hard. I think that he's got the right kind of people in. I mean, look, he's from Las Vegas. There's a few fighters out in the Las Vegas area that can teach you how to push yourself. But I don't think that Frank Mir is going to train hard because I just don't think that's how Frank Mir is right now. And I think it actually makes for a better fight, to be honest. If Frank Mir was in really, 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 really top-notch shape, I think this fight would be it would be too dangerous for Lesnar. Lesnar has a better chance because Mir is not in tip-top shape. And I think that ultimately will help the fans' enjoyment.
I have to agree with you on that, Mike. We're going to step away from USC for a minute. I'm going to be at the Frank Shamrock Kung Lee fight in March. Do you think that they're going to sell out the Shark Tank? 18,000?
I'll put a 5-star lock that says that they sell out that place. And this will be one of the biggest gates that has not been sponsored by the UFC in the history of North American mixed martial arts. Those two guys, I've been there live. I watched Frank Shamrock versus Phil Brony live last June, I want to say 22nd, I believe it was. That Frank is a real deal in that town. Kung Lee's been a real deal for years. Those two going against each other, I mean, I think that if they had an arena that's held 25,000 people, even 30,000 people, if they scaled the tickets at the right price, they could probably sell that many tickets. These guys are true icons in that area. I can recall sitting in the airport the day after the show, watching the news, and then they were showing highlights of Frank Shamrock. I mean, like he was just another sports figure in town. And, you know, I've never seen that before with mixed martial arts. I mean, the closest thing you ever saw was on ESPN a few times, and that was isolated. This just looked like ordinary coverage for everybody. So I believe that fight is a guaranteed 5-star lock sellout. I have no doubt that that show will be almost an instant sellout because those two guys against one another, total money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and
yeah,
since we want to talk about figures and buy rates, I'm real curious because since UFC's been working with WWE and TNA, in fact, if you go to WWE.com, I know earlier today they had a big spread of Brock Lesnar on the website, which surprised me. Now, what do you see, how do you think this is the wrestling fan, the wrestling audience is going to react to this fight, and how many potential buys do you see this pay-per-view getting?
I would think that this fight does at least 600,000 buys. My how I look at UFC pay-per-view buys has dramatically changed, particularly since they had the Rashad Evans versus Michael Bisping fight back in November, UFC 78 from Newark, New Jersey, did over 400,000 buys. And that is two guys who are not mega stars. This is Brock freaking Lesnar making his debut. love him or hate him if you're an MMA fan, the guy is generating true passion amongst MMA fans. I think that there's a real curiosity amongst your fight fans to watch him perform to see if this pro wrestler really is the real deal. And your pro wrestling fans who've probably been around, I mean, if you're only a pro wrestling fan, you've heard about this MMA, you've heard about this Ultimate Fighting all this time, you're sitting there, you know, you're not quite into it, but, you know, at the same time, it's so popular, and all the friends that you used to hang out with on Sunday nights to watch the pay-per-views, now they're getting together on Saturday nights to watch pay-per-views, and you're probably wondering, what is all the hub about? I mean, what is the publicity going on with this? What is this Ultimate Fighting thing? If there's ever a UFC show that a casual pro wrestling fan is going to buy, it's this one. And I think that Brock Lesnar is probably good for 200,000 to 300,000, maybe 400,000 buys all on his own. This combined with people who are curious about MMA in general, this is their springboard. I mean, this is like back in the day, I think that Ken Shamrock provided a similar outlet for pro wrestling fans. You know, I want to try this UFC or this Pride thing. You know, there's that Ken Shamrock guy. I remember him from WWE TV. Lesnar's going to be the same thing. And I've seen the hype that they've done on TNA. I mean, just watching Kurt Angle talk about this. UFC has done a masterful job of building this show up, and I think that 600,000 buys is almost a baseline for this. And if it did 700,000, I would not be shocked.
Yeah, I think it's going to do over 7, but that's because that's figuring the pro wrestling fan curiosity type of angle there. But I'm looking down the card up and down it. For non-hardcore fans, it looks like it's a two-fight show. I think that the Horn fight's going to be fun, as well as, you know, Tyson Griffin. He brings it. Do you see any of the matches being, you know, a sleeper match?
If I had to pick one sleeper, off the top of my head, I would say that the Marvin Eastman fight versus Terry Martin could be a sleeper. You got two guys who are both just kind of pseudo-journeyman middleweights. Eastman fought at 205 and 85. Marvin Eastman had gone on a decent little run at 185 until he ran into a big right hand from Chris Lieben. They're both sluggers. They both kind of go out there and just bring it. They're kind of ugly brawlers. Terry Martin's actually a fascinating character. He's from right here in the Chicago area. He is working towards his doctorate. He actually got his degree, his master's degree from the same school that I'm currently attending. So he's a very learned man. He's got a degrees in, I think, it's philosophy and maybe psychology. I mean, he's a very intelligent person, has kind of a rough and tumble background, came from the streets of Chicago, literally grew up in gang-infested areas, and now he's kind of turned his life around, got out of the ghetto, and kind of became a true success story, both intellectually as well as physically. And I think that him and Marvin Eastman could surprise people. I mean, I thought the Terry Martin versus Chris Lieben fight from back in September of last year was a really fun little slugfest, and Eastman's not really known for – he's not known for, like, being the greatest fighter of all time or anything like that, but he still likes to stand and trade with people. And I think this is just going to be what people want to see, two giant black dudes beating the crap out of each other. This is Sokoju versus Houston Alexander, if that fight had ever taken place.
Now, I want to bring it back to a buy rate question real fast. Now, has UFC done any research into because I know a big thing with UFC is going to your local bar or going to a local Hooters and getting together with a large group of friends and watching the show. And oftentimes, many Hooters in my areas are often packed out with people watching the UFC shows. Now, do you know how that affects the overall pay-per-view buys? And is there anything UFC – I mean, first of all, does it affect it at all?
I probably not. I mean – UFC is a group event. I know that when I watch the pay-per-views, I get together with Jay Bennett from the Figure Four Weekly board. We get together. We have a few guys over, four or five of us, watching the shows. And that's what fights are about. Fights are about guys getting together, eating a lot of pizza, watching grown men beat the crap out of each other. It's not the kind of thing where people order it and they sit alone in the room all by themselves watching it. It's not like pro wrestling where you kind of got to be ashamed and you don't let your friends know you ordered the pay-per-view, so you watch it by yourself. I mean, MMA fights, UFC is a social gathering. And, yeah, there's something to the idea that if 40 people go to the bar and all watch it, only one person's actually ordering it. Although I think that they actually make increased revenue because I think that they probably charge the bar a higher rights fee. But if there's 40 people at the bar, that's potentially 40 people that are interested in the sport not buying it. But on the flip side, that's still 40 people getting exposed to your sport. And you can probably be sure that 30 of them at minimum aren't that big into it, but you can kind of hook them And then when the big fight does come, you get your Tito Ortiz, Chuck Liddell Part 2, or Quentin Jackson versus Chuck Liddell Part 2, pretty much any time Chuck has a rematch with someone, seems to set a record, then they'll all kind of, you've set this goodwill. So I don't think that the bar thing really hurts the UFC. In fact, I think it probably helps them in the long run. It just increases their exposure to the general public.
As far as that bar thing, UFC's making enough money on the pay-per-views. You know, they're making enough revenue, so they're not going to worry. It's the whole idea of new eyes seeing the product. That's, you know, it's the same type of outlook as far as giving out comp tickets to a show. It's the same exact thing. You're going to give people something for free, and then they're going to get hooked, and they're going to come back. And UFC's not freaking out about the bar stuff because they're secure with their manhood, per se, you know, because they know they're going to make their money. They know they're going to have these people checking out their product. So, I mean, it's really not that big of a deal. But
and plus, I would like to stress that I'm pretty sure the bars don't just pay $45 and get the pay-per-view
right.
And put it on all the TV they want. I mean, I know that there's a lot of times they got to pay several $100 for those fights because they're a bar and they have an extra eyeballs watching it. So I'm sure that at the end of the day, like you said, the UFC's not hurting on revenue right now. I mean, they're pulling in $200 million a year, $100 million after they split it with the cable companies or whatever. I mean, this company's making a little bit of money right now. I think they're pretty happy.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Well, we're going to skip right to the top of the card. Big Nog and Sylvia. What do you think, Michael?
Well, and
actually, are you gonna be able to stay awake during the fight? That's the question.
Oh, I will. Oh, I always stay away for Tim Sylvia fights because they fill me with anger and hatred and rage. And I was at Tim Sylvia's last fight live at UFC 77 from Cincinnati, Ohio. We took on Brandon Vera. And I'm sitting in press row A, seat 15. I'm 8 feet from the cage, and there were times I almost wanted to get up and jump in the cage and just punch Tim Sylvia and go, "See, that's what a punch looks like. That's what you're supposed to do in a fight." But I mean, look. It's an interesting fight, and it's really difficult because Rodrigo Nogueira is one of the most talented heavyweights the sport has ever seen. I mean, the man has solid hands and truly world-class jiu-jitsu. He can take a beating like nobody else can. Nobody in the sport can take a beating like Nogueira can. And he's just withstood punishment after punishment. And he's fought guys that are similar to Tim Sylvia. And, you know, I mean, he beat Zulu, who's 400 pounds. He beat Bob Sapp, who's 350 pounds of pure muscle. He beat Semi Schilt, who's 7'2" and a world-class kickboxer. I mean, Nogueira's been in there with everybody that you can imagine, every style. I mean, you take the freaks, he's beaten truly world-class, well-rounded guys like Heath Herring and Sergey Harry-Tonoff and Josh Barnett and Mirko Krokop. I mean, if there's a heavyweight out there who's not named Fyodor Emelianenko, Nogueira's beat him. Tim Sylvia, he's beat some guys as well. I mean, Andrei Arlovski is no pushover. In fact, Andrei Arlovski is like a less talented but more athletic and bigger version of Nogueira. You know, Arlovski's got solid hands, a decent ground game, but he's a little more athletic than Nogueira. And Big Tim Sylvia is able to use that reach of his and his jab. And he fights ugly. He fights boring. I don't particularly enjoy him being on the card because I think that he's kind of embodies everything that can be wrong with fighters sometimes because he truly has a win-first mentality. But there's no denying that Tim Sylvia wins. And I give the man credit for that. He does what he has to do to win, and for him, that's the most important thing in the world. It's an interesting matchup here, but I pretty much think it comes down to the fact that I think Tim Sylvia is going to be a little too tentative because he has been tentative in the past basically 2 years, 25 rounds of fights. He's 18 rounds of fights, I believe. He's been incredibly tentative. He just doesn't pull the trigger. And against someone like Nogueira, the more opportunities you give him, the more openings you allow to present themselves, the greater chance of Nogueira is going to capitalize on it. The man is a finisher. He can catch you with an armbar or triangle or any kind of choke. He can catch you with a submission any time that it presents itself. And I think that ultimately that will happen. I think that Tim Sylvia's unwillingness to engage in fights will be his undoing. His tentative style, which he's used in the past to keep people at bay, to frustrate opponents, will, I think, end up haunting Tim Sylvia in this one. And I like Rodrigo Nogueira by submission sometime in the second or third round.
Now, you said on this show and then on your own radio show that you pick Nogueira to win the fight. But how much of a factor do you think it is? Because Nogueira, especially in Pride and then even in his first fight in the UFC, he's been through some wars. and now he's a little bit of age, and then the classic Bob Sapp fight that he did have, it's been a couple of years from now. It was a couple of years ago. So what Nogueira are we going to see enter the cage? Is it going to be the Pride Nogueira that was very dominant, who could beat everyone in the world except for Fedor? Or do you think we're going to see maybe a little bit slower, maybe a guy who's not the Nogueira that we're used to seeing? What do you think the odds of that are?
I think that we're going to see a very good Nogueira. I mean, everybody looks at the Herring fight back in July at UFC 73 Stacked, in which they point and go, oh, look, Nogueira didn't look like that great. But the truth is, with the exception of literally one kick that landed, Nogueira schooled Herring almost as bad as he did in the first and second fights. And this fight right before that was against Josh Barnett, and Barnett's still an incredible fighter, and Nogueira went toe-to-toe with Barnett and pulled out a victory over the babyface assassin. I think that Nogueira is going to be in great shape. I think he's going to be a great fighter, and I'm not going to put too much credence into the idea that he's been beaten down, because one, I don't know if Tim Sylvia is going to beat him down, and two, if Tim Sylvia beats Rodrigo Nogueira, I'm not going to make excuses for Nogueira. I'm coming out saying Nogueira's at his best right now, and if Tim Sylvia beats him, he beats the best Nogueira there is. I haven't seen any signs that Nogueira's truly a different fighter. This isn't quite like Miracle Krokop, where he shows up in the UFC and he's noticeably different. I mean, Krokop was just not the same guy he was in Pride for whatever reason. Seriously. But, I mean, I think Nogueira is going to be very good. And if he loses, it's not because he's been beaten down over the years. It's because Tim Sylvia is just a really awkward, tough dude to fight. And he's a tough son of a bitch to beat.
You brought up a very interesting name in Josh Barnett. Now, do you know if UFC having any interest in bringing in Josh Barnett?
I mean, I'm sure there are people in the UFC that would like to bring in Josh Barnett. My instinct would tell me that Joe Silva would have no problem with him. I know Dana White doesn't like Josh Barnett. There's a few people in the MMA community that Dana White just doesn't like to deal with. Josh Barnett, Frank Shamrock, Tito Ortiz is becoming persona non grata with the UFC. I don't think I'm going to see Josh Barnett in the UFC anytime soon. I think Barnett has a long-term vision for what he wants to be, and I think that he understands that he works better in Japan than he does in America, where he can parlay his MMA success into the world of pro wrestling, which was kind of Josh's first love. I think that he recognizes that, and that ultimately he wants to be, you know, 40 years old doing kind of work shoot or just completely work pro wrestling in Japan. And when it comes to the UFC, he minimizes and diminishes some of his appeal and notoriety over in the Land of the Rising Sun. And for that reason, I think Josh Barnett's more apt to sign, not necessarily just with a Japanese company, but with a company that will allow him to continue to explore Japanese interests. If you're with the UFC, you can't go over and do a Hustle show or a New Japan Pro Wrestling event or anything of the sort. You're doing only the UFC. I think Josh Barnett prizes, rightfully so, his ability to kind of maneuver in this field and that field.
Okay. And so skipping forward to the next UFC card, on March 1st, 2008, we have UFC 82. Now, the thing that I'm worried about the most is I think Dan Henderson has a really good chance of beating Anderson Silva. But first of all, I would like you to break down that fight. And the thing that worries me about it is if Dan Henderson can't beat Anderson Silva, then I really can't think of a name who can.
Yeah, but Dan Henderson absolutely can beat Anderson Silva. I mean, Silva's demolished people in the clinch. That is his bread and butter. Just his Muay Thai plum clinch is just otherworldly. But you're talking Dan freaking Henderson here. I mean, this guy is a true world-class Greco-Roman wrestler. If there's a middleweight on this planet, not named Matt Lindland, that can take apart Anderson Silva inside the clinch, it's Dan Henderson. Henderson is an athlete. He's got a phenomenal chin and a damn heavy right hand. Anderson Silva, of course, is just a freak. I mean, the guy's got the best striking currently. He's adapted his striking better to MMA than anybody ever has in the sport. He has true pinpoint accuracy and real power with every strike he throws. He doesn't waste motion. But at the same time, I mean, he's got some weaknesses. He keeps his hands a little low. Rich Franklin caught him with a few right hands, and if there's one thing Dan Henderson has, it's a big, big right hand. The X factor to me is just where's Anderson Silva's head at right now. He's been running through people, Rich Franklin twice, Nathan Marquardt, Travis Luter, Chris Lieben. I mean, and he's just beating people with such ease that it's almost otherworldly, and I wonder if that starts taking the toll on him as far as does he start coasting? Does Anderson Silva start buying his own hype? Does he wake up every day thinking, I'm Anderson effing Silva? I can be anybody I want. Come on now. I don't need to train that hard. Did he lose some of that fire in his belly? And on the flip side of Dan Henderson, he's 38, 39 years old. Well, with the exception of Randy Couture, most people tend to break down when they get older. No offense to anybody out there listening who's kind of old, but you old people just break down. That's what happens to the human body. You perform better at my age of 24 than you do at Dan Henderson's age of 38. Again, Randy Couture notwithstanding. So I'm wondering when Dan Henderson will get hit by Father Time. I mean, he's not a reckless guy. He's not a chocolate old party guy or anything like that. But Dan Henderson's been in a number of wars and over in Japan, and he's fought. Remember, Dan Henderson's fought, with the exception of a small run at the end there in Pride, he pretty much fought at 205 pounds. And for a dude that really doesn't have to cut that much weight to make 185, that's given up a lot of weight. And even though he had a lot of success, obviously beating Wanderlei Silva and Vitor Belfort, contending well with Rogério Nogueira. I mean, been in there with some of the top guys in the world at that weight. At the same time, that takes its toll on you. And that combined with his age makes me wonder when Dan Henderson will break down. I'm still not sure on who's going to win this fight. I got a month to watch all the videotape I can and try and see if I can find any glaring holes in each fighter's game that matches up well. But I'm really looking forward to this. I should be at this show live. It's in Columbus. That's within 5 hours of me. I can make the drive out there. Hopefully I'll be sitting there cage side. And this is a really awesome fight. This is a high-level middleweight competition. I mean, this is as good as you get it. 185 pounds. If you're not satisfied by Dan Henderson fighting Anderson Silva, nothing will ever satisfy you because these guys are as good as it gets.
Now, another fight that's announced on that card is he's pairing against Chick Congo. Now, do you want to predict the winner now, or do you want to wait a little bit?
I'm going to wait a little bit. I've been focusing more on UFC 81 lately, but, I mean, that's kind of an odd little fight. Chuck Congo is developing momentum. He just beats Mirko Krokop. He's got the look. I mean, Chuck Congo's got that look that every promoter drools over. Giant black man, ripped muscles, likes to just get out there and bang and beat the crap out of everyone. Looks like he can't be hurt by a single punch, and everything he throws looks like it's going to end his opponent's life. I mean, Chuck Congo is absolutely – I would love to see Chuck Congo versus Tim Sylvia. To me, that would just be a phenomenal fight. At the same time, he's hearing that this is a damn dangerous opponent for someone like Chuck Congo. I mean, hearing he's 1-2 in the UFC, lost to Jake O'Brien, Rodrigo Nogueira, won a sloppy fight against Brad Imes. He's got a decent takedown on him. He's more well-rounded than Chuck Congo. But Herring, for his part, likes to stand and throw. I mean, Herring likes to bang with guys a little bit. And Congo's got a decent little sprawl. I think that if I had to pick a winner right now, I would say Chuck Congo wins by knockout because I think he's just a little more athletic and a little stronger than Herring is. And that's saying something because he's Herring's a big dude. Herring's a real, true, legitimate 250 pounds of man right there. But I think Chuck Congo's going to probably knock out Heath Herring in some sort of spectacular fashion.
Okay, since you keep bringing up black men, I want to go to another black man, a man in MMA. When Kimbo Slice knocked out Tank Abbott, is Boss Rutten already giving his seal of approval on Kimbo Slice? Do you ever see the MMA's world being able to take Kimbo Slice seriously?
I think if Kimbo Slice kept winning fights today, you would take him seriously. I don't think he's going to. I think he's always going to be a sideshow attraction. And that's fine. He's doing what he's doing. The EXC, I think, understands his limitations. I think if they put him in there with, like, Antonio Silva, he would get mauled. And I would actually pay money to watch Antonio Silva fight Kimbo Slice because he would literally almost be mauled. I think Antonio Silva might actually eat Kimbo Slice if they fought one another. But I think Kimbo Slice is just – he's just becoming the next generation Tank Abbott, just kind of the mythical street fighter. And it at the root of everything – there's something to that. The people dislike the idea of a guy who just gets off the bar stool and just beats the crap out of everyone. And we think that guys that look tough and hit hard and can take a punch should be able to win sometimes. It's counterintuitive. It goes against what everyone has learned about real fighting over the years, which, you know, obviously the ground game's importance, being well-rounded, cross-training, et cetera, but there is a place for Kimbo Slice in the sport. And I don't think he's going to exceed that place, and I think people will probably understand him for what he is. I give credit to Kimbo for working people into giving him a big contract. I don't think that he draws any real money in for a while, but the man, he's the 2008 version of Tank Abbott.
Oh, wow. Okay, so speaking of working people, is there any update on the IFL status? Have they secured a television deal for next year?
I wouldn't know the IFL status if they sent me press releases, which they do all the time. And I just kind of look at them, I glance at them, and I delete them because it's the IFL and nobody pays attention to the IFL. I don't even think the IFL pays attention to the IFL. I think that the people inside that promotion, I think Boss Rutten is more concerned with what Kimbo Slice does against Tank Abbott than he is about the future of the IFL. The promotion is dead in the water. I will go on record right now. The IFL ain't making money. It's got a flawed concept and a lack of fighters, and I don't know if there's ever going to be a successful number two promotion in the United States. If there is, it ain't going to be the IFL.
Now, why do you think that there'll be a successful number two promotion? Is it because promoters don't know how to be successful in the world of mixed martial arts? They can't secure a good enough TV deal, or what do you think?
I think it's part of it's just a difficult sport to do. I mean, the UFC only has a limited number of guys they can use to get over, and you know, there's so many things you need. You need to have a real television outlet that people get behind and watch, and you need to develop characters and stars. You need to develop guys that are at the same, they're both dual personalities and top flight talent, and that's tough to do. I mean, you take a guy like Tito Ortiz, you know, a guy who can actually fight, who has a charisma and a personality about him. That's really rare, and it's tough to develop stuff like that. Usually, you know, you get guys who got a lot of charisma. You get like a thick Kimbo Slice. All this charisma, people like him. He's got a look and everything. But he can't really fight all that well. He's not a great fighter. So people aren't going to get really behind him. And at the opposite end of the spectrum within Elite Extreme Combat is Antonio Silva, one of the freakiest 265-pound fighters on the planet. Awesome speed, awesome technique, sort of a real deal heavyweight. But he ain't really got a personality, and I don't think he'll ever become a true draw. And I think that there's so many things going against somebody to become a number two in the sport. And chief amongst them might be the most important thing is that people watch Ultimate Fighting. They don't watch mixed martial arts. People want to watch Ultimate Fighters. It's like there's no number two football league. I mean, there's the Arena Football League, but it's not – you can't even call that a number two league. It's no competition to the NFL. I mean, there's no competition to Major League Baseball or the NFL. Or hockey or basketball. I mean, those are the sport. It's a sport. You watch, and you want to watch football, you watch the NFL. People don't think of watching the NFL as watching a specific league. That's what football is. And if you want to watch mixed martial arts, you're going to watch the Ultimate Fighting Championship. They are positioning themselves intelligently, I believe, as the NFL of the fighting world. And so could there be a number two promotion? I think so. I mean, you can make money in this sport. Strikeforce makes money doing just live events. I think that a promotion can make money. I don't think they can be the WCW to UFC's WWF anytime soon, though.
Well, thank you for the wrestling analogy, because I was actually about to break out in a wrestling analogy, because I know you're also a wrestling fan. Now, I had a discussion the other day with my friend, and I was explaining to him how Ohio Valley works with WWE. Now, how is UFC cultivating upcoming talent other than the Ultimate Fighter Show? How aggressive are they in seeking out new talent?
They don't really develop talent in the same way that pro wrestling does, because you know it really is just a completely different beast. They have the WEC, they have some lesser talent there, and I would suspect that if anybody in the WEC ever blew up and became a real deal at 155, 70, or 80, 85, they might bring them up. But at the same time, I don't know if that's the case. They got a guy named Carlos Condit. He's the 170-pound champion of the WEC. I have him a legitimate top 10 talent at welterweight, but I don't think the UFC is in any hurry to bring him into the fold. Top talent, MMA, it's like boxing. You know, fighters develop at a small, local level, and it's up to Joe Silva and some of the other guys inside the UFC to spot talent and bring them along. I mean, they're signing guys. Like, they just signed a guy named Shane Carwin, who's a real dude at 265 pounds, real heavyweight challenger and all that. But it's tough, you know? I mean, you got to kind of bring up guys and find top dudes who are really good somewhere and snatch them up before the other promotions get them. And you're going to see the UFC signing more guys. The UFC is going to have more burns than more busts than success in the near future, because they're going to have to start taking risks. Because if they don't sign a guy, Elite XC will. Or World Victory Road over in Japan will sign someone, or K1, or Bodog will rear its ugly head and waste $1 million, something like that. I mean, they're gonna have to sign untested guys, hoping that they develop into something truly world class in the future. And you know, some of that may be they can outbid EXC. I mean, you got somebody like Jake Shields as an Elite Extreme Combat. If the UFC wanted Jake Shields and Shields' contract came due, they could have got him. They have the money to offer. They could have signed Jake Shields. They could have had one of the top 10 welterweights on the planet. They didn't need him yet. And I think if there's any real talent out there, if the UFC really wants the guy, they can get him. But as far as them actively cultivating talent, they don't really have a feeder system or anything like that. They use the Ultimate Fighter, although the appeal of that show is lessening over time, because I think that more fighters are just saying, why on earth do I want to live in a house with a bunch of other sweaty, half-naked men for a few months when I can just fight on one of your shows and get just as much exposure? I mean, when the Ultimate Fighter first started, that magical first season with Stephen Bonner and Forrest Griffin and Diego Sanchez and Josh Koscheck and Chris Lieben and all these real talented dudes, that was it. If you wanted to be in the UFC, that was like really was like your best chance. That was like kind of taking a shortcut. And nowadays, not so much. I mean, they're kind of scraping the bottom of the talent pool, and you're seeing some of these guys get on the show, and they ain't all that good. And, I mean, I always joke that I'm one fight away from being the Ultimate Fighter, but, damn, when they're putting 32 men, the rumors that 32 men in the next season, and they'll all fight and to eliminate each other in the first week or something, you're getting to the point where if you've watched the UFC, you might be on the Ultimate Fighter someday. I mean, they're really kind of stretching because there's just not that much talent out there right now.
I have to agree with you on that one, Michael. Well, we're gonna lighten up the show a little bit. We're going to discuss your boss on the F4WOnline.com website. Have you had a chance to watch any of Brian's in-ring work?
Yeah, I've actually watched some of what Super Chico does. We can't break kayfabe there. He's Super Chico when he's wrestling. I mean, I've seen Brian wrestle, yeah.
Cool. Well, what do you think of him?
I would say Brian's a fine little pro wrestler. I'm not a pro wrestler. I can't really judge guys too well, but Brian wrestles the kind of style I think a lot of fans would appreciate. Just kind of very simple, basic. He doesn't do anything stupid or crazy. If you want to watch a man get lit on fire, don't watch a Chico Alvarez tape. He ain't going to do it. But if you want to watch somebody who kind of builds up his matches, has his 8 to 10 minute little match there, it's solid, it's good, it gets a high spot here and there. He works a safe, smart style where you're not going to get crazy or hurt. That's what a Chico Alvarez match is. And, you know, I haven't seen tons of Brian Alvarez matches, but I've probably seen about a dozen or so. And they're never bad, the hair match notwithstanding, and they're usually decently entertaining. I mean, I think that if most people watched a Brian Alvarez pro wrestling match, they would walk away saying, yeah, that was fine. I enjoyed myself. That was a good time.
Yeah, I think I agree with him that he was born 10 years too late.
Yeah, exactly. Brian Alvarez wrestles like somebody out of the 1970s who does a moonsault every once in a while.
And never hits it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, he's not going to hurt anyone, yeah.
So, what do you think of Brian as a boss?
Brian Alvarez is
any,
a dream boss.
He's
a great boss.
Does he put any restrictions on you at all, or...?
No, I wish you'd pay me a lot more, but except for the millions of dollars I'm not getting paid every year, I can do whatever I want. I can write anything I want at any time. Brian's never put a restriction on me that I've ever been aware of. I mean, I write something, he publishes it. I record a show, he puts it up. He never tells me, Mike, you got to cut down on this. And, you know, my show's crossed the line and here and there and a few awful comedy skits have failed. But, I mean, look, anybody who's ever been to figure4online.com, they're aware that place is out of control and nuts, and my show fits in. It's got its own little corner of the empire, so to speak, and Brian never has had any restrictions on me. I'm sure if I ever cross the line, he'd let me know, but I'm not really the kind of guy that would probably do that. I don't really want to go nuts or anything like that, but if every boss was like Chico Alvarez, I think people would be very happy. And I'm not just saying that because he's my boss or because I get along with him or anything like that. I mean, he really does give me free rein to do what I want to do, and I really appreciate that.
Five Star Radio would not be what it is, the entity that it is, without that creative freedom.
I wouldn't call it creative, but yeah, absolutely.
I must say, Mike, the show has advanced, you know, to a whole nother level since you dropped the Randy Orton skits. But
Randy Orton appears he rears his ugly head every once in a while. But yeah, mostly I just kind of lazy and didn't want to write stuff out in advance, and it's just easier for me to just, oh, this is the card, just kind of preview it. Just most of the time, Most people, I don't know if everybody realizes, but most of my previews, I just kind of do off the top of my head. I don't take notes. I don't pull up websites. I just kind of know all this stuff. I don't know why I know it all, but yep, I've mostly just gotten lazy lately. And the show's quality has improved as I've gotten lazy, which tells me that I'm the problem with my show. The more work I do, the more of me I put into the program, the worse it gets. So Five Star Radio really needs less of me in order to be a success, which is a little bit disconcerting.
Okay, after this show, I'm going to rip that little piece of audio there, and I'm going to send in a shout-out for Monday's Brian and Vinny show. The rest of the world that is not listening to Rubber Guard Radio right now needs to hear that. But that aside, so you're going to law school?
Yes, sir.
Cool. What type of law?
Well, I'm literally studying all of it right now. That's how it works. You literally have to study every piece of law there is, and then after 3 years of ball-breaking work, you take a giant test you have to study for 6 weeks. It's like 2 or 3 days, and takes like 8 hours a day, which will literally quiz me on everything I've ever learned about the law, including my name, which I've forgotten by now. I don't even know my own name. They give me a number. I am literally a number. You always talk about like how the Nazis were branded to the Jews with numbers, and that's where they were identified. Literally in law school, you don't have a name. You write down a number on everything you do. So I'm just a number right now, and that's okay. I'm just their bitch, and one day they'll give me a degree, and I will go out in the world and probably ruin someone's life because I didn't pay attention enough in class or something like that. It's really a scary proposition, the idea that I could ever represent anyone in any way, shape, or form in a public forum. That's just ridiculous. And I think I might sue the law school if they gave me a degree because that would clearly be a sign that they have no standards.
I was going to be nice and not say that, but you did, so that's okay. So how long have you been writing in general?
Let's see. I first started writing for WrestlingObserver.com in August of 2002, so 5.5 years now I've been doing all this, and I don't know how it's kept happening. I don't know why people keep publishing my stuff. I think it's even more absurd that somebody pays me even a modest sum to do this, but it does happen, and it's ridiculous. It shouldn't happen. I am living proof that America has no standards when it comes to the Internet.
Wow. As far as new subscribers signing up to the Figure Four Empire, I believe that there should be a button where when you're signing up, that you should be able to choose which option, like what got you there, like what show got you there. I signed up because of the free Dr. Keith shows. There should be a button like that so that you guys, it might be an incentive or bonus type program, so then maybe we can get the Adam and Mike show, you know, higher up on par because they are slipping. But I think that this way that we'll actually know, you know, who's drawing the money and who's not. What do you think?
That is why this is precisely a horrible idea. I do not need to have quantifiable proof that I bring nothing to the table. Right now, I have a good deal going. I'm pulling the wool over Chico's eyes, and I do not need to have that exposed to the world.
Well,
I'll pick it up now.
So it's out now, but that's
yeah.
Okay. Alex, you need to take over, brother. I think Alex is sleeping.
I do that a lot. Anybody who listens to me for any appreciable period of time ends up going to sleep. Let me tell you, I've got a mother, a father, a brother, a dog, a girlfriend, friends, aunts, uncles, cousins, listeners, readers. Anybody who spends time with me always goes right to sleep. My middle name is Somnambulant, so it's really an awful curse that I bear. But it's okay. It works for getting the ladies because, you know, I put them to sleep real easy, and then, you know, I can have my way with their television set. So it's good fun.
Actually, how's Brother Brian? Hold on just a sec, Alex. We haven't heard from Brother Brian in a while. How's he doing? What's up with him?
Brother Brian's been committed to a mental asylum. He's doing okay. He gets his Valium on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Xanax on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But Brother Brian's... Yeah, I mean, I tried to get some of the Valium, but he bit me, and that's why we put him back in the home. But Brother Brian does all right. He's actually working on something for Five Star Radio. He won't tell me what it is, which is generally a sign that it will be vulgar, disturbing, and disgusting, and probably violate several laws. but he says he's working on it, and I don't know if it's ever going to come to fruition, but Brother Brian still exists in the world. He's still alive. I have not murdered him. I've tried a few times. I threw a puggle at him, and the puggle just licked his face, which I thought was disturbing. I thought the dog would eat his face. But the damn puggle is just, he's a licker, not a biter, and that stands me. So I have no weapon to use against Brother Brian. But one day I will get him. I will end him. He is my sworn enemy, and I shall banish him from this earth. He will rue the day that he ever was born.
So when did you start getting into professional wrestling, and how soon after that did you get into mixed martial arts? So were you a mixed martial arts fan first, and then you got into pro wrestling? Or can you just give us a little bit of your history of being a fan?
Let's see. When I got into pro wrestling, mixed martial arts literally didn't exist except for as a concept in Brazil with the Gracies or something like that. Let's see. I was born in 1980, February 11th, 1983. That's right, everybody. It's coming up. I was born in 1983, and my first memory of life is probably from my Monday, 85, 86, and I was already watching pro wrestling. I've literally watched this as long as I can remember, and, you know, I've always been a pro wrestling fan, probably because I have feelings of inadequacy and need to expose myself to big, hairy, sweaty men. But let's see, I became an MMA fan somewhere. I mean, I first became aware of it around UFC 4 or 5, but I watched it, and I didn't really understand what was going on. I think the first fight I ever watched in full was the second Hoist Gracie Ken Shamrock fight, 33 and a half minutes. It was a weird deal there, boring kind of hump fest, and which really wasn't the best exposure for a neophyte to the sport. But I slowly got into it more and more in the late 90s as I was entering high school, about 14 and 15, about 10 years ago, I guess, I started getting MMA. And then when I got exposed to Kazushi Sakuraba for the first time, that's really when I think that I went from being a pro wrestling fan that watched MMA to an MMA fan. I mean, it was Kazushi Sakuraba who I believe is the greatest bridge between professional fighting and professional wrestling, and that man has always had a special place in my heart. That's why I flew out to Los Angeles to watch him at the K1 Dynamite show in the Los Angeles Coliseum. I just wanted to see Saku once in my life. I got to see him live. It was just an incredible experience just for that. And probably so was Sakuraba's rise and pride is really when I solidified myself. It's just, this is all I want in life. I mean, I was watching before. I saw a little bit of Frank Shamrock and such in his UFC run. But it's really Sakuraba's run in pride that's made me think this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Speaking of Kazushi Sakuraba, what was your favorite outfit that he ever walked into the ring in?
My favorite outfit, my favorite gimmick Sakuraba ever did, I think it was against Hoist Gracie, when it was like him and two other dudes all came down to the ring wearing masks, and nobody knew which one was Sakuraba. And when he took off the mask and the crowd went nuts, that was like an incredible moment, because think about it. He's Kazushi Sakuraba. He's fighting the legendary Hoist Gracie, the unbeaten, ignoring the Harold Howard fight. I think it was Harold Howard. Hoist Gracie, the Gracie of all the Gracies, in a fight that ended up going 90 minutes. I mean, the biggest fight of Sakuraba's entire career, the fight that made him a legend, a hero to the Japanese people, and he's pulling off wacky little dances and gimmicks before the fight starts. I mean, what kind of a man does it? I mean, I had my one professional fight there, and I was just trying not to, you know, pee my pants as I'm walking out of the cage. Sakuraba is doing the gimmicks. I mean, that is Kazushi Sakuraba right there. That is why I've always been in awe of him. I mean, in that fight, I mean, it's like the 75-minute mark. Think about that for a second. There is a professional fight in which there was a 75-minute mark. That's insane. Here he's throwing double chops and stomps and flying jumps and all this. It's like, are you crazy? You're in the biggest fight of all time, and you're still thinking, I need to entertain people. That, to me, is why Sakuraba is just incredible. Yes, his wins are awesome. He beat some of the greatest fighters of all time in their prime, and he gave up 30 or 40 pounds to these guys. But to me, it was Sakuraba's willingness and true desire to entertain that has always set him apart from everyone else. I mean, BJ Penn, and right now BJ Penn I think is the greatest talent the sport has at this moment, but he doesn't have like this urge to entertain people. He wants to go out there and beat them. He is a fighter. Sakuraba was an entertainer, and for that reason I've always loved Kazushi Sakuraba.
The one thing I'll remember other than the entire Sakuraba Gracie fight is I remember when the two guys and him came down the mask. I don't know if you remember this, but Antonio Inoki handed Hoist Gracie, and then he went to hand Sakuraba flowers, but he didn't know which one was the real Sakuraba. So all three masked men accepted the flowers and bowed to Antonio Inoki. I don't remember if you remember that.
I remember seeing that. And that, again, that's Sakuraba. He's goofing around. He wouldn't break kayfabe. He wouldn't break his character, even though he took flowers from Antonio Inoki. Minutes before, he then engaged in a fight. A fight. He was going to go in there with a dude that wants to punch him in the face, and he's goofing off. He's nuts. And he's actually a certified drunk and an alcoholic, and that just adds to Sakuraba's charm.
Now, since you are such a large Sakuraba fan, have you seen any of his professional wrestling matches?
I have actually watched a little bit of Saku's workshoot stuff, and it's pretty good, pretty entertaining. He's not at the level of Kiyoshi Tamura, but Sakuraba knew what he was doing in there, and I think if he had stuck with pro wrestling, he would have been a good pro wrestler, but not a great one. And I think he made the right choice because in MMA, he seemed to find his stride. I think you're going to find few and far between people, the number of people out there are few and far between that believe that Sakuraba didn't exactly have a good MMA career.
Okay.
Well,
then,
he was a hell of a pro wrestler before.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he knew what he was doing with his pro wrestling, and again, that translates to how he acted in MMA. He understood what the deal was. He understood that people paid to be entertained. Tim Sylvia should learn this. Tim Sylvia wants to win. Sakuraba understood. People are plunking down 50, 100, 200. I mean, some people are spending thousands of dollars for ringside seats. They want to be entertained, not just to see who is the best. They want to be entertained at the same time as seeing who is the best. And Sakuraba understood that. And to me, that is the sign of respect that he had for his fans that he would do that. I mean, it truly shows a respectful fighter. Tim Sylvia kind of disrespects his fans, if he has any, by being boring and methodical and plotting because people have a lot of options in life. I mean, you can buy anything in the world. You can be entertained by anything. You watch 500 channels and on-demand HD this and porn on the internet that and all the kinds of stuff. So you got to really earn somebody's money. And if somebody takes their money and gives it to you and says, entertain me, and you don't do it, and then you afterwards go, well, I'm just trying to win my fight. That's what I do. That's kind of disrespectful. And Kazushi Sakuraba understood your average person, this is their outlet in life. This is what they do for entertainment and to escape from the realities of their life. And he always put on a good show. Win, lose, or draw. I don't think he ever had a draw. Oh, he actually did have a draw. Sakuraba always entertained people.
I have to agree with you. Well, Mike, we're going to wrap things up. I really appreciate you coming on the show this week. It was definitely my pleasure and Alex's as well. I'm going to give you the office the opportunity to plug whatever you need to plug.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Anybody listening to this, figure4online.com. You can read my latest columns up there right now for free. This week I have a free edition of Five Star Radio, so if you're not a subscriber to the figure4online.com website, it's okay. You can stop by. This week's Five Star Radio does a nice little hour in-depth preview of UFC 81. If you heard liked what you heard on this show, I go even more in-depth with my analysis of Frank Mir, Brock Lesnar, Tim Sylvia, Nogueira, and all the other fun fights of the night. It's a free show, so you can listen to that. And I've also become very involved in what is a great charity, the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life right here in DeKalb, Illinois, where I'm going to be relaying for life, walking with a group of other law students. We are raising money to fight cancer. You can find a link for that on my latest column. If you're on the Figure 4 board, my signature has this link. I believe the website is ACS, as in American Cancer Society, acsevents.org/go-to/Mike Coughlin. You can donate any amount of money you want, from $5 to $500. And if you donate $500, I will personally call you up on the phone and thank you. I will cut your lawn if you live in the Chicago area if you donate $500. So, I mean, I'm really kind of getting behind this. I mean, it's cancer, you know. I mean, I'm raising money to fight cancer. This isn't anything controversial. There's no condoms involved. There's no blood for oil. There's no war in this. There's no abortion in that. It's just cancer. Everybody deals with cancer at one time or another in life. I mean, I lost 3 grandparents to cancer. I lost an uncle to cancer. My mother was a cancer survivor. I mean, and I'm not unique. There's lots of everybody. I mean, you find me somebody in this world that hasn't been touched in some way by cancer, and I'll find you a liar. So I'm really kind of getting behind that. And other than that, like I said, figure4online.com and wrestlingobserver.com. And that's all you need out of me. And if you need any more of me, there's something really wrong with you. And I would suggest you get psychological counseling.
All right, Mike. I really appreciate you coming on, brother. We will definitely have you on again. You want to say goodbye, Alex?
Oh, goodbye, Mr. Costas.
All right, you guys. Thank you very much for having me on. And I want to apologize publicly for missing the last show. I got swamped and had some technical difficulties, but I was glad to do the show this week. Thank you guys very much for this opportunity.
Not a problem. Thank you, Michael. And we will definitely talk to you soon.
Great.
All right, Alex. Wow. That was a show. That was definitely a show.
That was a show.
We survived. We definitely survived. Okay, we have Jessica, not the wife, but Jessica behind me making fun of me. She's singing Gloria Gaynor. So, anything can happen here on Rebel Guard Radio. MySpace.com/CM Saint. That's Alex's MySpace. Ours will be MySpace.com/Rebel Guard Radio. We're looking at getting a Rebel Guard Radio website so we can archive everything. But we're running down to our last few seconds. Alex, I will be talking to you soon. And listeners, we will see you next week.
Blog Talk Radio.